Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with a monthly news broadcast for members and friends of the club for November 2024. This month, instead of the usual broadcast, we will offer an historical broadcast from years past. The usual news and information will be broadcast next month. I'm Andrew, VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. I have broadcast files going back as far as 2001. Many of the older files aren't the greatest as far as technical quality goes, archived in either Real Audio or Windows Media Audio format. These produced a smaller file size back in the days when the leading edge technology was dial-up internet. Remember that? This month we have an original broadcast from August 2002. Details on when to hear these news and information broadcasts are available at the club website, www.raotc.org.au. The VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email, raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's broadcast.
Hi there. This is Alan Doble, VK3AMD, and Associated Relay Stations is VK3OTN, the registered call sign of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia, Incorporated. I'll repeat that last word, incorporated, because we became incorporated as from July the 8th this year. Our registered number is A004278-0C. I'll repeat that, A004278-0C. After all the hard work by the committee, it was very gratifying that the documents we had to submit were accepted without any need for redrafting. The biggest job was the required very extensive constitution. As you all need to know what it says, it will be printed in the forthcoming September issue of OTN Magazine. And the rules require that we give notice of the annual general meeting together with the nomination form for members of the committee. These documents will also be printed in the September issue of OTN. And I'm sorry to say that about 20 members have not yet renewed their now overdue subscriptions without any notice or advice to the secretary. So if you do not receive this as September issue, it would probably be due to this oversight. This is a VK3OTN. Here in Melbourne, we're planning a luncheon at the Bentley Club on Tuesday, September the 17th, and the guest speaker will be Steve Mason, who will talk about the wartime top secret work of the Australian Army's Signal Special Wireless Units, which worked in the places such as Syria, Greece and Crete, copying German and Italian wireless traffic before returning to Australia and New Guinea and further north to work on the Japanese traffic. Steve edits the journal Inc. Emma Inc., the newsletter of the Australian Special Wireless Group Association. Radin 5RK advises that the annual luncheon will be held at their favourite location, the Marion Hotel in Mitchell Park, on Thursday, October the 24th at 12:30 p.m. Booking should be made with Jack Townsend, VK5HT, Radin 5RK, or Ron Coate, VK3RV, before October the 10th. Put it in your diary now. I'll give you another reminder next month. And our friends in Perth will meet for their usual luncheon at the Bayswater Tavern tomorrow week, Tuesday, August the 13th, at the usual time. This is VK3OTN. Stuart Day, VK3ESD, a long-time producer of OTN, is unable to produce the September issue because he's involved in the complex job of moving from his South Gippsland location on the eastern shore of Western Port Bay to his previous business address in suburban Huntingdale. This involves building operations, the usual moving of furniture, and the tricky bit, his computer and printing equipment, plus his very extensive collection of musical items, sound systems, pianos, and of course his dearly loved organs and pianos. So Bill Roper, BK3BR, has very kindly volunteered to produce the September issue and is currently working on it. We can't grudge Stuart this break because in the past 11 years he's produced 21 of the 28 issues we have had up to date, so all without cost to the club. This is an enormous effort for which we must all be grateful. So how do we go about producing the September issue of OTN? Well, thankfully Bill Roper has volunteered to do the job and is currently working hard at it. Size has been standardized at A4 and the inside front cover has been redesigned to provide basic information about the club. This is VK3OTN. Today we welcome to our membership Nick Watling, VK4YT. He becomes full member number 1263. And Gordon Welch, VK5KGS, he becomes associate member 1264. If any of the new members are listening today, as we hope you are, please identify yourselves in one or other of the callback sessions. It is with regret we record the passing promise of Alan Cook, VK3AUC, who was member number 949 and a long-time member of our committee, and Ray Jepson, VK3JI, who was member number 102. And both of these members were very keen CW operators, apart from their other radio interests. Several club members attended the funerals of these two members. Helen Vaig has also passed away, VK3AGV, who is member number 884. Helen was a commercial operator with the Coastal Radio Service at Bulolo and transferred to the Army at the outbreak of war. He reached the rank of captain and was mentioned in dispatches three times. Pre-war, he copied the last messages from Amelia Earhart's plane as it disappeared over the Pacific. We pause for a few moments now in memory of these friends. And what about Alan Cook, who, as I said, was a member of our committee for several years until his death on July the 7th. He grew up in Caulfield, went to Melbourne High School and worked at Australian paper manufacturers until joining the RAAF in 1943 at the age of 18. He trained as a radar operator and served near Cairns, then at Mornington Island, Port Moresby and other places. And after the war, he returned to Australian paper manufacturers where he worked until his retirement in 1986. Post-war, he studied and qualified in accountancy. He was first licensed in September 1950 with his call sign BK3AUC. Alan was an active constructor and a very keen CW operator and highly regarded worldwide in this field. Excuse me. He was a keen and skilled artist in both sketching and painting as well as being a very good photographer. In 1970, he cooperated with our brother group in England, celebrating the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Beam Wireless Service between England and Australia. He was unable to take part in the 75th anniversary of the same event in April this year, but alerted me to it, so that as VK3OTN, the club did take part very successfully. Alan is survived by his wife Barbara, his son David, together with his daughters Judith and Penelope, and their six children. 73, Alan, however. This is VK3OTN. The Australian Army Signals Museum is well worth a visit. It has a lot of very interesting equipment and very well arranged and displayed. It is open one day each week, and that's Tuesday, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Volunteers will show you around and answer questions. It is located in its own building at the Simpson Barracks, which is the home of the Army School of Signals. Simpson's Barracks is complex is entered from Greensboro Road in McLeod. The Millway map reference number is number 20 and runs from D to H in one direction and 79 in the other. The museum itself is shown near the top right-hand corner of this area. You need a car to get there rather than public transport, so why not get a couple of mates to join you? Having said that, all that, there's an item on World War II radio equipment the museum really needs to fill a gap in its collection. It is wireless set number 208, repeat 208. This was a low-power portable CW-only transceiver, measuring 9.5 inches by 8 inches by 7 inches high, in a khaki metal case with a black panel. Its operating frequency was from 2.5 to 3.8 megs at less than 1 watt from its 99-volt drive battery. Excuse me. It was manufactured by Radio Corporation toward the end of the war. If you can supply one of these or know where one can be found in any condition, please contact me on 0395704610 anytime, or Neil Wayne, the museum's assistant curator, on 03-943-53505. I'll repeat that. Neil Wayne, 943-53505, any time. This is VK3OTN. Radio Amateur and Timeless Club listeners who served in World War II and who lost radio amateur relatives or friends during the war will be interested to have read the July issue of the WIA's AR magazine, especially in view of the fact that the annual Remembrance Day contest will take place on the weekend of the 17th and 18th of this month. Col Harvey, VK1AU, has spent many hours over the past couple of years to find out what really happened to the 26 amateurs whose names are read out before the start of each Remembrance Day contest. There is no record of this research being done by anyone else, and these details have never been published, except for some of them in earlier editions of our own magazine, OTN. If you are interested and don't have access to AR magazine, there's just a possibility that some news agent near you might still have a copy of the July issue. If this last statement is a surprise, the August issue of AR has been available through some news agents and is shortly available, and increasing copies are now being available through news agents. This is VK3OTN. We're indebted to the magazine Amateur Radio Action, dated April 1987, for the following item. It's about the late Maurie Anderson, who died in 1960. He was first licensed as 5MA early in the 1920s and became a seagoing operator on one of the last sailing ships in 1927. The ship was the American-based E.R. Sterling, and that's spelled S-T-E-R-L-I-N-G, sailing out of Adelaide. This story is in his own words and was first published in the magazine Radio, dated June 1st, 1928. And it reads, "We left Adelaide in fine weather on Saturday morning, the 16th of April, 1927, and from the time of lifting our anchor, we were followed by bad luck and adverse conditions. For 2 days, a strong head wind forced us to tack back and forth across the Gulf of St. Vincent before eventually sailing out, passing Cape Border. Here the winds were in favour for a westerly trip, that's via the Cape of Good Hope. But our voyage was planned via Cape Horn. We sailed westwards until the wind changed, and then the ship was put about on a new course for Cape Horn, going south of Tasmania. Bad luck followed us closely, and when almost clear of Tasmania, the wind changed to a point which made it absolutely impossible to sail safely further south of Tasmania. This meant turning back and proceeding through Bass Strait, and this detoured and made us a fortnight. The next stage of our journey was down south of New Zealand. On several occasions in these waters, I was able to chat direct with my people at home via South Australian experimental stations, who were also telephone subscribers. My signals were answered from my home via telephone, and shortwave radio replies were almost immediately received on board. Here again, fate stepped in, and the dynamo burnt out due to a radio frequency leak. This meant no radio or lights, as the damage was too extensive to be repaired at sea, but a makeshift contraption was available in the form of a 5-horsepower electric motor. This I screwed to the deck, and the belt drive was rigged from the flywheel of the petrol motor, but on starting up it was found that the meters showed no signs of output. After testing various circuits, it was discovered there was no circuit through the field coils. Closer inspection showed that salt water had gained access to the fine copper winding and eaten through in many places. After joining these fractures, a more serious defect showed up. This wire was enamel coated, and while being handled, the enamel, which was brittle with age, cracked off, leaving the bare copper. The pot of enamel insulating varnish luckily was among the stores, so I commenced the long, tedious job of enameling these many hundreds of feet of wire by hand. After many tedious hours of work, these two coils were completed and replaced on the pole pieces of the motor. The speed at which this motor had to be driven in order to maintain an output great enough to supply the ship's wireless alternator was excessive, and the petrol motor would not run at this speed without undue overheating. Once again, after reducing the number of turns, this old motor was encouraged to generate, and we were once more in communication with the world. A job of this nature is considered small when done in a workshop on shore, but when done on board a sailing vessel in the roaring 40s, it's a horse of another colour. The shortwave set and dynamator, filters, etc. had to be dismantled and packed away below for a couple of weeks while we were down south, owing to the tremendous seas breaking on board and gaining access to the radio room. One large wave broke in the door of the shack and swept it off its hinges. Shortly after passing Antipodes Island, a peculiar change took place with signals from the Rugby Long Wave Station. The tone of his signal became split as though I was receiving it both ways around the world, one signal a fraction before the other. At this time, we were practically on the spot of the globe directly opposite where Rugby is situated. It was about these latitudes that we began to realize the value of shortwave radio, as our course was much further south than that taken by steamers, so that we were isolated except for the fact that shortwave signals were not affected by distance even while sailing among icebergs, which act as effective screens to ordinary wireless signals. We still enjoyed musical programs and speeches from such distant places as New York University and could also distinctly hear dishes rattling while listening to dinner dance music from large hotels in New York. Look at a map of South America, and you will better understand how this was appreciated. We were at that time between 300 and 400 miles south of Cape Horn, the furthest point south of 58 degrees south latitude. A heavy gale was encountered off the Falkland Islands, and after many anxious periods, the vessel defied fate once more, but not before the main and mizzen masts crashed to the rail. These huge masts measured approximately 3 feet in diameter at the deck and are over 100 feet in length, weighing several tons. The base of the main mast crashed through the roof of the forward house, smashing the cook's cabin to pieces, and these masts were finally swept overboard by the mountainous seas and continued to drag over our starboard sides as they were still held fast to the ship by their wire ropes and rigging. We were threatened by a still greater danger. One of these wooden masts floated up at our stern, striking the rudder with great force several times before the wire rigging was cut through with saws and axes, allowing the wreckage to go free. One of the lifeboats, which was on top of the forward house, was discovered beneath the wreckage, crushed flat as though made of paper. The galley stove was turned over by the falling mast as it crashed through the topside, leaving the deck spread with a mixture of dough, saucepans, and hot ashes. The immense sails blew up toy balloons and burst into thousands of shreds. After weathering this storm, our course was altered for Montevideo, where it was hoped the damage to the rigging could be repaired, but on finding the vessel was still manageable, we continued on our journey to England, as this was the destination of our cargo of 4,000 tons of wheat. On starting the large gas engine to hoist sails after this disaster, it fired late owing to being waterlogged and ripped several teeth out of the timing gear wheel, putting the winch immediately out of action. This meant that the sails would have to be hoisted by hand in rough weather. This was almost impossible, as sails are very unruly things while hanging loose. as they would be during the slow process of hoisting by hand. Some of them never reached the top. I set to work on the timing wheel to insert artificial steel teeth. The foundations of these teeth were drilled with a small hand drill. Each tooth was replaced by three artificial studs side by side, and after a week of practically continuous labelling, this engine was once more in commission and we were able to hoist sail once more. I mention these incidents as an explanation, and the reason why, as wireless operator of a sailing vessel, I was unable to keep a nightly schedule of transmission as impossible as is possible the station operated on shore. Sparks on a sailing vessel is called upon to act in many capacities other than a brass pounder. By the way, this is VK3ATN. Again, shortwave radio came to the fore, and news of our mishap was flashed through the vessel's home port, Seattle, near Michigan, and American stations were communicated with between South America and Africa, obtaining maximum strength reports on many occasions. Many Argentinian, Brazilian, and Chilean experimental stations were heard and worked well off the coast of South America. This work was done on a temporary aerial and rigged up when the main aerial was carried away during the gale that partially dismasted us. A new permanent twin aerial was erected well off the South American coast. Broadcasting stations received very well here, but their identity is unknown to me, as their announcements were made in foreign languages. The next misfortune occurred off the Cape Verde Islands when a terrific tropical hurricane caught us at 4 a.m. on the 4th of September. About 7 a.m., five of the sailors were still out on the yards of the foremost taking in sail, but by some natural instinct, one came down to the deck and the others followed closely, only to reach the deck just in time to see the mast stop, snap off at the foreyard, and almost simultaneously snap in a second place just below the topsail as it commenced to fall squarely on top of the forecastle house and galley. But just as the wreckage, which weighed 10 to 15 tons, was about to crush the housing to splinters, with only about 20 feet more to fall, the ship rolled heavily to starboard, sending the wreckage over the starboard side. This cumbersome mast dragged by the ship's side, held by the steel rope, dangerously probing and seriously denting the side of the hull, until it was set free to sink to the bottom with the exception of a piece of a topsail yard which floated by us for some time, indicating that we were making no progress. At this time, a huge wave leapt angrily over the rail to the deck, smashing the pump and one ventilator off face with the decks. The mast hatch was then discovered to have two strong backs broken and one cover smashed. The captain called all hands to the poop deck. One seaman was swept off his feet while attempting to reach the poop and escape without injury. Much less wreckage was hurled dangerously from one side of the deck to the other with great force, and remaining portions of the badly torn sails were lashed over the main hatchway, preventing the heavy seas from washing the hatch covers loose. The ventilator cavity was also patched up, and for a few minutes after the main hatch cover was discovered to have caved in, it looked as though we were safe for just as long as it took to fill the hole with water. And as many hundreds of tons leapt over the rails every few minutes, you may guess we spent a few actions moments. I had a schedule with 8DLD and Mr. Prescott of Michigan at 2 a.m. each morning. I told him on this particular morning that it was too rough to chat with him. I had just gone below when I was told the ship was in a hurricane. When I arrived on deck, all sails on the foremast were in ribbons except the upper topsail. I had to rip the binnacle standers to prevent myself from being blown away. This is VK3ATN. The wind was fierce and the seas were mountainous and quite white in appearance. The large twin aerial had been carried away when the foremast crashed, and the heavy seas had gained access to the engine room, immediately putting out of action the petrol engine which drives the radio power unit. The emergency coil was therefore the only available power for transmitting. I then rigged up a temporary single wire aerial from the top of the remaining mast and reached to the top of the stump of the foremast. The aerial insulators near the deck next gave trouble. owing to the fact that the continuous seas breaking over the vessel had completely saturated these insulators with salt water, causing them to break down when attempts were made to use the high voltage emergency coil. The temporary aerial would not stand the tremendous strain of the ship rolling and was once again scattered to the winds. After a third attempt, the aerial stayed put and I turned my attention to the waterlogged petrol engine. Eventually, I managed to receive replies to my SOS signals. About this time, Mr. Roderick McKenzie, the chief officer, died from injuries received during the hurricane. A British steamer replying to our feeble signals offered to take us in tow. This, however, was declined by Captain Sterling, so we drifted westwards in this crippled condition until at daybreak one morning, we were sighted by an American naval training ship, the USS Greene, 200 miles off our original course. He offered to take us in tow free of charge. This was accepted, and October the 15th, we were towed into the harbour of St. Thomas Naval Base in the Virgin Islands, off the USA, after sighting no land for 6 months. St. Thomas, with St. Croix, became under the Stars and Stripes in 1917, being purchased by America from Denmark. They're situated about 500 miles southeast of Florida. These islands are reputed to be unequaled in the tropics for mild and equable climate. Romantic and famous characters have been there. There are such pirates as Adolf Esmet, Gene Hanlon, Tempest Rogers, Gene Martell, Captain Kidd, and Captain Teach, Blackbeard. The castle of the latter is still intact. Here I received the utmost hospitality from members of the American Radio Relay League who were keen to do experiments. I was taken for a day cruise around the group of islands on board the Grebe, and the population consisted mainly of West Indians. And I'll have to start cutting this short. After spending 6 weeks in England, I sailed from Liverpool on a liner bound for Sydney, and while in Cape Town, I met Mr. Oxenham, owner of F04AL, well known on short waves throughout the world, and spent an evening at the Cape Town Broadcasting Station. This completes my trip around the world with shortwave radio. The outfit I had with me was probably heard by many listeners while in operation from my home in Cheltenham, South Australia, signing 5MA. The power used at sea was 30 watts, obtained from a 500-volt dynamator, driven by power obtained from a 6-volt battery. Some of the best communications were established when American stations in the Midwest were communicated with from Port Adelaide docks, and when south of New Zealand, Canadians were worked. Conditions for shortwave radio on a sailing ship during some of the weather conditions under which these experiments were tried cannot be compared with shore conditions, and I guess you could say that again. Murray was appointed to the first operator of the newly established Flying Doctor Base in Cloncurry for the wage of £6 a week. Outback reception conditions were not very good. The Morse code received was not always copyable. One year he travelled nearly 3,500 miles in the outback servicing radios and the network. He also supplied weather reports to KLM for its service between Sydney and Europe. And that's quite a story, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And I think I might skip another item I was going to give, in this case this goes on just a bit too long. I have an interesting one here from Harry Major about the legendary National HRO receiver and how it got its name. It was printed in the magazine Practical Wireless in May 1985 and reads as follows. The author is Charles E. Miller, and under the heading of Bell Communication Receivers, he writes, "The National HRO, a postscript. During my research for the article on the HRO, I made many attempts to discover just what the three letters stood for, but without success. It was even suggested to me that they were completely meaningless, like the S in Harry S. Truman's name. At last, however, the investigative patience of one of my spies has paid off, and I am able to bring you the truth of the matter, or at least a very plausible explanation. Since the HRO is considered to be very much the province of the amateur, it may come as a shock to find that it was developed to meet a purely commercial need in the American aviation industry. At the beginning of the 1930s, civil airlines in the USA were confined largely to daylight flying, since navigational aids were at a minimum. What few night flights were made depended on light beacons set on high ground to keep them on the straight and narrow, since the primitive radio equipment then available was not reliable enough for consistent communications. The U.S. Department of Commerce was anxious to remedy this situation, proposing a nationwide network of radio beacons and ground-to-air speech facilities. Contracts were let to several noted radio and electrical firms for the supply of the necessary transmitters and receivers. General Electric America made the ground-based transmitters, Aircraft Radio Corp. the airborne equipment, and what was then a minor radio manufacturer was asked to develop a ground-based receiver, as was the National Company of New Melbourne in Massachusetts. The director of the project for National was James Millen, a licensed hand whose call sign was originally 2BY Peter and changed to W1HRX. The first result was a receiver known as the AGS, the Aviation Ground Station. This being a fairly simple superhead employing plug-in coils. Many of the airlines adopted the AGS, but others felt that something more sophisticated was called for. Transcontinental and Western Airlines engaged Herbert Hoover Jr., W6ZH, the sometime president of the AARL, to work in conjunction with Jim Millen on a state-of-the-art receiver. Hoover set up a small laboratory directed by Howard Morgan of the Western Electric Company, in which the purely electrical design of the new receiver was to be carried out, whilst the mechanical work was in the hands of Millen, 3,000 miles away on the East Coast. This involved much overtime on the part of toolmakers working on the various dies and jigs used to build the chassis, screening cans, and other metal components. These men had to complete their time sheets for the work they put in, and the forms normally being allocated a serial number or letters to indicate what particular job was involved. No official serial having been given to the new receiver, the workmen created one of their own because the job had to be carried out at top speed. They called it HOR, for Hell of a Rush. The initial stuck, and so it was as the HOR that Millen took the completed prototype chassis to Hoover's laboratory for the wiring job and subsequent testing. Naturally enough, there were a few unexpected snags that had to be corrected, but in all, this was a great success. Arrangements were made in December 1930 to announce it in the December 1934 issue of magazine QSD. Just in time, someone realized the letters HOR might be capable of another interpretation or pronunciation, and they reshuffled to make it HRO. So there you have it. I can only say that if it isn't true, it ought to be, recalling the famous editor who once said, if the legend outstrips the truth, print the legend. And that was written by Chas Miller, with grateful thanks to Ray Williams, who made it all possible. This is VK3OTN for the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club. We invite interested amateurs to join the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club Incorporated. There are two grades of membership. Full membership is available for those who have been licensed for 25 years or more. And associated membership is available to those who have been licensed for 10 years or more. Age does not enter into it. Subscriptions are currently $8 per annum, plus a joining fee of $5. These figures apply to both grades of membership. Members get two interesting magazines each year, one in March and one in September, and associate members become full members automatically when the 25-year date comes up. Associate members cannot hold office in the club. That's the only real difference. If you would like to receive the membership application form, please contact Bank Secretary Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, telephone number 03 9598 4262, repeat 03 9598 4262, or myself, Alan Doble, BK3AMD, telephone 03 9570 4610, repeat 03 9570 4610, and we're both QTHR in any call book. This is VK3OGN. And a lady was leaving to spend a couple of weeks in England to attend a conference. When she's leaving, she asked her husband if there's anything he'd like her to bring back for him. He laughed a bit and said, well, a lovely young English girl would be very nice. When the lady returned home, the husband asked if she'd acted on his request, and she said, well, I tried my hardest, and I do hope it turns out to be a girl. And that, on that happy note, I guess I'll be reading it until next month. This is Alan Global, VK3AND, and Associated Relay Stations is VK3ATN, the official call sign of the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club of Australia, Incorporated. We're now concluding our transmission for this month and hope you found it interesting and enjoyable. We'll be on the air again on Monday the 2nd of September and Monday the 7th of October at the same times and the same frequencies as today.
You have been listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia. This concludes this month's news and information bulletin. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies, and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. 73 everyone.